So I want to move on to contextuality today. And this goes back originally to Koch and Specker. Back, I forgot to write the year down. I think this is 1960 something. I'm going to say 66. And then more recently, the subject was revised by Speckens, by Rob Speckens, in 2004. So it's good. If you want to do original research in this area, it's good if the first three letters of your name start with S, P, and E. So key to this area of research is to try and impose a certain notion of classicality onto quantum theory and then to see that it doesn't work. So the notion is called non-contextuality. And I'm going to give, first of all, the standard assumption from Koken and Specker. And later on, I'll give the revised assumptions that Rob Speckens came up with. So you have this assumption, then there's a theorem that says that quantum theory has to be contextual. It violates this assumption. Chris Isham, who is a very well-known researcher in quantum gravity and quantum foundations at Imperial College, thinks that the Koch and Specker theorem is the most important result in physics. I think it's something it should be taught on the very first day of an undergraduate university degree. So some people think this is a really, really important result. So here's the idea. I'll write the assumption out in full. So in each run of an experiment, at any given time, at a given time, there is an underlying value in other words, we denote these values by V of A so the A is some operator, just a standard Hermitian operator in quantum theory. And this value takes one of the values of the eigenvalues of the eigenvalues associated with this operator. And we make an assertion that this is the value in that particular run of the experiment that would be seen if we make a measurement at this time of that operator. Furthermore, this is the non-contextuality part. I should go over here. This value is independent of any other things you measure at the same time. You have a commuting observables. I mean, if you're measuring these observables at the same time, they have to be commuting. So what that means is the value of A, given that you also measure B, is equal to the value of A, given that you measure C. I'm just going to write it as the value of A, where we're assuming that all these things commute. Although we're not assuming that A and that B and C commute. Because we're just interested in things that could be measured with A. So we could measure A and B, or we could measure A and C, because they commute in each case. So what's going on here is that an attempt is being made to think about these observables classically. The idea is that there's some underlying state of reality which simply has the value of the observable. It should be equal to one of the eigenvalues then, because, and then when you look, you simply see that value. Classically, it doesn't matter what else you measure at the same time. You know, if you're measuring the position of a particle, it doesn't matter if you also look and try to measure something, some other object. Or if you're measuring the spin of a particle, it doesn't matter what else you measure at the same time. So that's the assumption of non-contextuality. Any questions? No. Because over here, so you can think of B as the context for the measurement A. And the value doesn't depend on whether the context is B or C. Okay. So it's an attempt to think classically. It's a formal attempt to think classically, and it leads to a theorem that you can't do this in quantum theory. So here's one type of observable. It's just a projection operator. So this is the projection operator onto the state U. This has eigenvalues 0 and 1. And we can find commuting sets when we have orthogonal states. So we have that the value associated with u is equal to 0 or 1. If we have an orthonormal set then they all commute. Well, actually, even if they're equal, they commute, so they all commute. Then you can say that the sum of the values must be equal to 1. Because if you perform a measurement of this, then you know you can only get 1 once. All the others have to give you 0. And by the definition, these values are supposed to be the values that are seen when you make a measurement. So even if you don't make a measurement, these values have to have the property that that they sum to 1, which means since they take values 0 or 1, only one of them can be equal to 1. And then all the other values are equal to 0 for any given orthonormal basis. Now, what powers this proof, the Kokensbecker theorem, is that you can have the same projector belonging to different orthonormal sets. So it belongs to more than one, let's say. So for example, diagrammatically, the projector that points along, say, this direction in the Hilbert space belongs to that orthonormal set. Can also belong to this orthonormal set. So in both of these cases, for a given run of the experiment, you want to have the same value associated with the one projector. And so you're going to have some kind of consistency constraints, because now you need to be able to ascribe a value 1 to one of the projectors and 0 to all the others. And you have to do it in a way which is consistent when you go between, from when you go to different sets of orthonormal bases, different orthonormal sets. So Koken and Speck have found a set of 117 vectors in 3D space, in 3D Hilbert space. That couldn't have the values assigned consistently. There's actually a, so over the years, people have tried to improve this and find smaller numbers of vectors. How enough? Koch and Speck have found 117 vectors like this. I don't know what kind of, some sort of amazing feat of, I just have no idea how you set about even doing that, especially back in 1960, whenever it was, before computers were readily available. So the current record for this kind of proof is Adam Cabello's 18 vector proof. And it's for a four-dimensional Hilbert space. Interestingly, he only needs to use states which have real coefficients to make this work. And so I'm certainly not going to write down 117 vectors on the blackboard. I'm not even going to write down 18. But I will just write the first few lines of the, I'll just give you a sense of how this proof works. So we put so this is the notation we're going to use. So this is the projector onto this state with coefficients A, B, C, D. We're just going to write that as to simplify the notation. And now there's a set of 9 equations, because here we have four-dimensional Hilbert space. So we have sets of 4 orthogonal orthonormal states like this. And we need to ascribe values consistently so that only one of those can have the value 1. The others have to have the value 0. Oh, and actually, just to save having to normalize these every time, I'm going to put some arbitrary k in front. So we're not going to worry about normalizing it. So these values here are just a set of numbers that you can then normalize to get the norm equal to 1. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could. Well, no, but I'm not going to assume normalization, so then you can't. And you've got the phase as well. Oh, but it's real. Yeah, you could. But I think clarity is given slightly better if you use all 4 numbers. I'll write it down and you'll see. Okay. So there's the first line. And if you go through, you can check that each of these corresponds to an orthogonal vector. And then the normalization is put in afterwards. Okay, there's the second one, and so on, down to 9 equations. Okay, and the exact form of these equations is in the next tutorial you have, which I think is later this afternoon. So when you look at this set of 9 equations, you'll see that each vector appears twice on the left-hand side. So I haven't written them all down, of course, but you can see, for example, here this one appears twice. And if you go through, everyone appears twice. Hence, the sum of the left-hand side of the all these equations is an even number, because these values are either equal to 0 or 1. So each is either contributing 0 or 2 to the total sum. It appears twice. However, we have 9 equations, so the sum of the right-hand sides is 9. Which is odd, last time I checked. So that means that you can't consistently ascribe these values, and you get a proof that quantum theory is contextual, or not non-contextual. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, you both raised your hands exactly simultaneously, but go on. Go, you're good.
I'm wondering what's new or surprising about this compared to like what we already know from, say, like an EPR type experiment. Because in that case, you know, if we try to assign underlying values to,
yeah. So in EPR experiment, actually you can ascribe values. It's just that they kind of go beyond the sort of wave function. So you have this violation of psi completeness. So if you assume locality, the particular state that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, the particular measurements they considered actually do allow you to assign values. However, there are examples such as the GHZ example, where you have say in that case it's 3 parties. Where you can't consistently ascribe values, but there you're using locality to justify the assumption of non-contextuality. So certainly, if what I have over here is not influenced by measurements over there, then I can have a justification, a locality justifying the non-contextuality assumption. So locality is thrown into the mix, is what I'm saying there. It's a slightly different situation because you're introducing locality. Yeah, this could just be one particle sitting in one place in your laboratory. It only relies on the fact that you have 18. You need a 4-dimensional Hall space. That's all. Farah.
Yeah, I have a few. First, it seems like in
a
2-dimensional Hilbert space, you can't.
That's right. Yeah.
So, quantum theory can be contextual in
Right. So for a two-dimensional Hilbert space, this kind of proof will not go through, because the moment you choose your one state, you're fixing the other orthogonal state, the other orthogonal projector. So there's no way you can get this context. Although interestingly, if you go to the Speckens type notion of contextuality, you can then consider two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. What you do is you consider, rather than using projection valued measures, you use positive operator valued measures. Did you cover those with Joe? Okay. So then you can have more than two states. You can have more than two positive operators associated with your measurement, and you can say some interesting things. Well, I think the moment you have it in for any number of dimensions, then every dimension higher, it kind of follows. You can just keep adding zeros at the end. So maybe what you mean is, has it been proven in the general case in an interesting way? Is that?
I mean, a realistic case would be like an infinite dimension on the
space. Okay. Well, then you can always just pick out some set of some like four orthogonal states within that infinite dimensional Hilbert space, and use those to run your fourth orthogonal station. You can use those then to run your proof. So it also applies in that case. It's sufficient for it to be true for some subspace in the Hilbert space. I mean, people often draw pictures. There's often people draw graph theoretical so graphs that indicate this. So I think so. You have a bunch of points, and then you only you connect them if they belong to. You draw things like this if they belong to the same orthonormal set, and then for each such set, you would have to have a 1 on one location and a 0 on the other, and then you try to show that you can't label the vertexes consistent with all the things you have. And there's been a lot of work done recently on developing this kind of graphical point of view, which I haven't studied, so I can't give you a very much insight into it. But many of the postdocs here have looked at that.
Yeah. On that note, at least in the 3D case, I read this paper like a while ago, so I don't remember all of the details. But those aren't like 117 random vectors that would have been totally intractable. Like they're positioned on the cube in such a way that I think that Hogan and Specker did have kind of a simple geometrical explanation of like why this doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, and like Penrose who has very good geometrical insight, has drawn these beautiful pictures of with corresponding to these points, showing that they correspond to, I forget the shapes. They're in his Emperor's New Mind book. So there's a lot of that thinking going on. I can't tell you much about it. Okay. Any more questions on this? Nope. So let me move on to the Speckens version of contextuality. So you can find this paper on the archive. So it's from 2004. And this refers to the ontological model framework. And so now I need to set up a few definitions to give this Speckens notion of non-contextuality. So we'll say P and P prime, two different preparations, are in the same equivalence class. Call that EP. If this is true, so P and P prime are in the same equivalence class if, for all measurements and all outcomes of those measurements, we get the same probabilities. And likewise, M and M prime well, it's the same thing, just with M instead. So then, Speckens defines he defines a few notions of non-contextuality. So preparation. Preparation non-contextuality. So a model or theory is preparation non-contextual. If you have the same distributions over ontic states for preparations in the same equivalence class. And then you can just put you can just write the distribution like that. Any questions on that? No. So see if I can, and indeed, there's going to be proofs that you can't have this, and so it actually can't follow because there are hidden driver models. So so the thing about the equivalence class is you're averaging over any on-take states. You're averaging over lambda. You're taking the integral over lambda. Whereas this is a statement about the distribution over the on-take state. So it could be that you could have different distributions for different preparations, but you don't see it when you average over them. So a very basic model that would do that would be imagine if your distributions were completely non-overlapping. So for p preparation devices, the distribution was over here. For p primed cases, it was over here. But when you did the averaging, you couldn't see that at the coarse graining level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In what sense, p and p prime, what is defines the equivalence class?
It's sort of operational equivalence, so you can't distinguish them. So do you have a box that implements p, and you have another box that implements p prime? So obviously those boxes are different because otherwise you wouldn't have different names for them. Maybe one box is red, the other one is blue. Maybe the internal workings of the box are also different. But you can't distinguish them by putting them in a circuit and looking at the probabilities. So if you're trying to distinguish them in this way, so where's the definition of equivalence? Here. If you try to distinguish them by making measurements, you'll find that they have all the same properties, as far as you can tell. So operationally, they're equivalent.
But if this equation here holds true, that the ontic state lambda is the same for p and p prime.
Right.
What could distinguish them? I mean,
then they're not distinguished. The whole point is this is an assumption we're making. It's called non-contextuality. This is the assumption of non.
The assumption is basically that equivalence classes only contain one.
Yeah. So the assumption is that exactly that only prepare one distribution. So the motivation I'll come to this in a let me give the motivation now. Is that operational equivalence is. Operational equivalence and ontological equivalence should imply each other. And Rob gives another example of this sort is the equivalence principle in general relativity. From inside this elevator, you can't tell if the elevator is falling or floating out in free space. So those are two operationally equivalent situations. And then you assume that they're ontologically equivalent, that they have the same, at least locally, they have the same, structure in terms of the metric and other fields. So this is attempting to take that kind of philosophy and apply it to this situation. Of course, it doesn't work, and there are theorems to show that you can't have this kind of non-contextuality. But that's the motivation for testing this. Okay, and then you can set up a similar definition of preparation, of measurement. Non-contextuality. So basically, it's the same idea. Now, there's an important notion, which is the notion of outcome determinism. We have outcome determinism. If this takes only values 0 or 1. So the idea then is that the outcome of the measurement is fully determined by the ontic state. So one thing that you can see that's happened here is that you just you can see the connection between the Speckens approach and the original way of defining contextuality, and in a sense, what Speckens is doing is he's separating out this assumption of outcome determinism from this assumption of non-contextuality, and those two notions kind of get conflated in the original definition. So it's good if you can have a more refined set of assumptions. You can ask more careful questions, and of course, also Speckens introduces. Well, I've given you two notions of non-contextuality: there's preparation and measurement. He also gives a third definition, which I won't give here, which is transformation non-contextuality. Let's see. So the good things about this approach are that the definitions are theory independent, so they work for any operational theory. Whereas the original Koch and Specker definitions require the apparatus of quantum theory. You want to talk about Hermitian operators and commuting sets and so on. So they apply, because they're theory independent, they apply to any operational situation, any operational theory. In particular, they apply to positive operator valued measures as well as PVs. And they separate out outcome determinism from the assumption of non-contextuality. So I'm not going to go through the actual proofs. They're in the paper, and they're not very difficult. But he proves, amongst other things, that preparation non-contextuality is not possible in quantum theory. And measurement non-contextuality in conjunction with outcome determinism for sharp measurements, by which we mean projection valued measurements. Are incompatible with quantum theory. So he proves this by making these assumptions and then deriving a contradiction in the context of certain examples. And he also has examples that apply to two-dimensional Hilbert spaces because you can treat POVMs in here. So that's all good. One question I want to return to is how natural is this assumption of non-contextuality, any of these assumptions? So it's interesting to look at the de Broglie-Bohm model. We know the de Broglie-Bohm model works. It reproduces quantum theory. It's a hidden variable model, so it's it fits into this ontological framework in a certain sense. And yet, because of these theorems, we know it has to be non-contextual. So how bad does non-contextuality in the context of the de Broglie-Bohm model look? So let's just give an example. Is this? Okay, so here's a very simple example. Imagine we have two paths. Okay, here's path one, and here's path two. And in some way, we prepare, somehow, a superposition. So we have a wave function that's in a superposition of being here and here in the de Broglie-Bohm model. And let's imagine that the de Broglie-Bohm particle is here. Okay. Well, we can perform a measurement. So we can think of this just as effectively a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which has got this path and this path. And we can perform a measurement onto, by putting detectors in here. This one projects onto, if it's in path A, and this one projects onto path B. And what's going to happen if this is a proper detection, so it magnifies the thing to a macroscopic level, is that the value in this case where I've drawn it, so the ontic state is this wave function plus the particle position up here. And so the value in this example is equal to, well, this is one, and likewise, and the and the value of for B is zero in this example. But imagine we have the same preparation same ontic state. And I'm going to perform the same measurement, but do it in a different way. So measure the same projectors, but in a slightly different way. Allow these two paths to cross in space. Same ontic state. Yeah. So in this case, we're assuming these are equal amplitudes. So these two wave packets are equal. Does everyone know what happens in this case?
Is there something that allows them to interfere where they cross?
So the two paths physically pass through each other.
There's no beam splitter.
Yeah. So you would imagine that. Oh, sorry, I made a mistake. So clearly, this is A, and this is B. Yeah, that's the whole point. So clearly, down here, this detector is measuring to see if you're in this path, and this detector is measuring to see if you're in this path.
You said that the actual projections cannot cross.
Right.
So then it should go that and go like that.
Exactly, yeah. So in this case, the trajectory goes into here, and this one flashes, or clicks, or whatever. But in this case, it goes into here. But this is the PB projection operator. So you have the same measurement, the same, operationally the same measurement, because we're measuring the same projection operators here, the same ontic state, and yet we get different values. In this case, the values are So the de Broglie-Bohm model is non-contextual. Sorry, it's contextual. In fact, it's more contextual than it has to be according to these theorems, because this is just a two-dimensional Hilbert space, effectively. So none of the theorems tell you you have to be contextual in this case, but it is contextual here. And so in a sense, you can see that there's a question as to whether this assumption is very natural, certainly in the only well worked out hidden rogue model we have, you can immediately see that it would have to be contextual. And it's not even in a surprising thing, it does it in a very natural way in some sense.
You define contextual by
Well, here we don't even need that. Here we just can't even ascribe values in a set of eigenvalues. Even just you can't, because this implicit in this saying that there's a value associated with an operator is that that's the same value for the whole equivalence class. And so we don't even have to use different measurements. It's certainly, if you want, you can also consider a slightly more complicated situation where you have three paths, and then you can show that it's affected by what measurement you make elsewhere. But you don't even need that. This is a very simple example that shows that the idea of assigning values in the de Broglie-Bohm model just doesn't work. Somehow the model is cleverer than that. Okay. So I'll stop there.